Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. More U.S. advisors heading to Iraq. President Obama has authorized deployment of another 450 U.S. military advisors to Western Iraq in an effort to equip, train, and advise Iraqi security forces battling Islamic State militants. It will bring to more than 3,500 the number of U.S. military personnel stationed in Iraq. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says the advisors will hope to mobilize Sunni tribesmen to take up arms against the IS group.
Those tribal fighters will also benefit from some of the advice and assist efforts that our military personnel are engaged in. They will benefit from the expedited transfer of weapons and equipment. And bringing them into this fight under the command and control of the Iraqi central government will be an important part of ensuring that we have Iraqi fighters on the ground who are fighting ISIL in their own country and even in their own communities.
The deployment follows a discussion of Iraqi strategy between President Obama and Iraq's prime minister on sidelines of this week's Group of Seven summit. The deputy UN peacekeeping official warned the Security Council Wednesday a Sudanese army offensive in restive Darfur has driven tens of thousands from their homes this year. Assistant Secretary General for Peacekeeping Edmund Mullet says the military operation against the rebels has had a devastating impact on civilians.
Criminality is also a major source of insecurity, with various armed persons taking advantage of the relative absence of security forces in most of the areas to attack civilians. This worsening security environment in parts of Darfur continues to have significant implications for the safety and security of humanitarian personnel and UNAMID.
The Security Council will decide this month whether to extend the peacekeeping mission for Darfur. This is VOA News. An Iran missile expert warned Congress Wednesday that 3 weeks before a deadline for a comprehensive nuclear agreement with Tehran, the failure to address the Islamic Republic's ballistic missile program in any agreement could be a dangerous omission. David Cooper of the U.S. Naval War College told a congressional panel Tehran possesses one of the largest ballistic missile arsenals in the region.
There is a very close correlation between longer range, meaning intermediate range and beyond ballistic missiles, and nuclear weapons power ambitions. And so at this moment, Iran is the only country in the world that says it has no nuclear weapons ambitions and yet has fielded an intermediate range ballistic missile.
International negotiators and Iran are working against a self-imposed June 30 deadline for a comprehensive nuclear agreement. African leaders Wednesday signed a 26-nation free trade agreement linking three economic blocs and creating a common market that will span half the continent.
A free trade agreement is an important milestone.
Speaking in Cairo Wednesday, World Bank President Jim Yong Kim called it a milestone for the economic future of Africa, connecting Cairo to Cape Town and much in between. The agreement will affect nearly 60% of the continent's population. It will still require negotiation and votes in national parliaments. The World Bank says the global economy is in for one more year of disappointing growth. Experts at the Global Lender now predict the economy will expand 2.8% this year as commerce confronts the impacts of falling oil prices and rising U.S. interest rates. Pope Francis has called on visiting Russian President Vladimir Putin to make a sincere effort to bring about peace to war-torn eastern Ukraine. A statement said the two leaders agreed on the importance of creating an atmosphere of dialogue that all parties commit to applying the Minsk ceasefire accord signed in February. Congolese soldiers backed by UN forces have launched a major operation against rebels of the Ituri Patriotic Resistance Force, or FRPI, in the northeast of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The operation is the largest since a successful joint operation defeated the M23 rebel group back in 2013. It also comes after a dispute between the DRC and the UN mission MONUSCO and UN cooperation with two Congolese generals who the UN accused of rights violations. Dozens of suspected Islamist militants in Mali attacked a police base in the town of Misenyi near the southern border with Ivory Coast on Wednesday. At least one gendarme was killed. Most such attacks have been confined to the country's desert north, where unrest has persisted since separatists and anti-Al-Qaeda fighters swept across the region following a coup in 2012. And the World Health Organization reports new cases of Ebola in Guinea and Sierra Leone for a second consecutive week. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's opposition parties unite ahead of the 2016 presidential election.
The last time we had a sort of alliance, we did not cooperate fully, and we began fighting among ourselves. We are going to go to this election united. We are going to cooperate at all levels.
Philip Wafula Ogutu is Uganda's minority leader in parliament. Burundi's political crisis is expected to dominate this week's African Union summit in South Africa. Nigeria's ruling APC party elects parliamentary leaders against the wishes of their party hierarchy. And the number of Ebola cases rise again in Sierra Leone.
The challenge that we have is that we continue to see people escaping from quarantine homes and move from Zambia to Potloko, from Potloko to the western area.
Dr. Brian Makabo is Chief Medical Officer of Sierra Leone, and the UN warns of tens of thousands of newly displaced in Sudan's Darfur region. Those stories plus Mark Omar Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The minority leader of Uganda's parliament says opposition groups have come together under one umbrella to challenge President Yoweri Museveni and his ruling National Resistance Movement, the NRM. The groups signed a protocol on Wednesday to form the Democratic Alliance ahead of next year's elections. Minority leader Philip Wafula Ogutu tells reporter Peter Clotty that the good thing about the new alliance is that it will prevent the splitting of votes among opposition groups, which has in the past led to victory for President Museveni and his NRM.
It's a very significant development in the politics of our country, in that all the major political parties have agreed to work together, including a section of the ruling party. We're excited because this is what we have been looking for, and the Ugandans, that's what they prefer. So we think that we should be moving forward, and we hope that the government is going to respond, because what brought us together initially was basically having electoral reforms and constitutional reforms, which can help us level the playing field for elections. We are going to continue with the pressure for the reforms. At the same time, we are preparing for the elections in case we get the reforms we want.
What do you think are the prospects of this new unity among the opposition parties? What advantage does this give you ahead of the elections next year?
The advantage is that we are not going to split to divide our votes. The advantage is that we are going to go to this election united. We are going to cooperate at all levels. People have been pushing us to do that. The last time we had a sort of an alliance, we did not cooperate fully, and we began fighting among ourselves and the public. About 40% of the public actually refused to vote. They just said they would waste their vote.
We also heard report that one particular political calculation is that the opposition are eyeing former Prime Minister Mbabazi, who is from the ruling NRM and who is regarded highly, and that choosing him as a presidential candidate for your party basically will split the NRM and make the opposition win. Is this part of the calculation?
No, as of now, I do not know who is going to be our presidential candidate, our joint presidential candidate. I do not know. Mbabazi could be one of them. What we are going to do is, before we decide to choose who, because we are going to choose by consensus, we are going to put them on a bus and we drive around the country and they do some sort of campaign among the public. The public will indicate to us whom they want, and most likely we shall choose that one.
So how has been the reaction of Ugandans since you announced this unity among all opposition groups in the country?
Many of them are very excited. They are calling us. They are saying that's what they wanted. They have been pushing for that and been waiting for that. They are happy. Of course, I haven't heard the reaction from those who are opposed to it. And also, those who have been skeptical that we have done this before. What is the difference? And again, like you asked me earlier, we are saying there's a difference with this one. We didn't have a vice president and an outgoing prime minister joining us.
Philip Wafula Ogutu is Uganda's opposition minority leader in parliament. He spoke to reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. African leaders are sure to spend much of their time at this weekend's African Union summit discussing the political crisis in Burundi, where President Pierre Nkurunziza insists he will run for a third term despite violent protests. Analysts say he's not the only Central African leader trying to hang on to power in the face of term limits and criticism both at home and abroad. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
As African leaders meet in Johannesburg this week for the twice-yearly African Union Summit, they have a big question before them. How do you solve a problem like Burundi? The tiny Central African nation has been beset by political violence over the decision by President Pierre Nkurunziza to run for a third term, despite the fact that the Constitution limits him to two. His decision spurred a failed coup attempt, multiple violent protests, and the worst crisis the nation has seen since the end of its brutal civil war in 2006. Jegan Gray Johnson of the Open Society Foundation Watchdog Group says at this point Mr. Nkurunziza's back is against a wall and that everyone saw this coming.
The situation in Burundi has been one of a train smash in slow motion. Everybody knew that we were going to get to this level. As far back as perhaps November, it was obvious that the current head of state was actually eyeing a third term. It was obvious that nothing was going to stop him. Now we've gotten to a point where he is stuck, and so is the rest of the African continent, in dealing with this particular problem between a rock and a hard place.
And he's not the only African leader in this position, says analyst Stephanie Walters of the Institute for Security Studies. Two of Mr. Nkurunziza's counterparts, the presidents of the Democratic Republic of Congo and the smaller Republic of Congo, currently appear to be trying to extend their terms as well. Walters says this worrying trend puts more pressure on the African Union to act on Burundi. She is among many analysts who predict that such actions could lead to future conflict.
And I think that it's a very emotional issue, and people feel very strongly about this, because what we're seeing actually is a reversal. These presidents are essentially turning their backs on those peace agreements, on the gains that have been made.
Analyst Yolande Buka of the Institute for Security Studies says the AU's reaction has been clear, and that AU chairwoman Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma has articulated the AU's position well. But she says more action needs to be taken before the situation gets worse in Burundi.
They said pretty much what I think they should have said. Dlamini-Zuma was very clear about thinking the third mandate is a bad decision. It's a bad decision not only for Burundi's consolidation of democracy, but for the region in general. It brings instability.
So what should the AU do about a problem like Burundi and possibly other African nations in coming years? Gray Johnson says they need to be firm and hold people responsible for any crimes committed. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The United Nations said Wednesday that nearly 80,000 more Darfuris have been displaced this year as the government of Sudan pursues the second phase of a military offensive to crush rebels in the region. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the United Nations.
UN Deputy Peacekeeping Chief Edmund Mulet told the Security Council that humanitarian organizations estimate that at least 78,000 people have been newly displaced in Darfur. He said in addition to that group, the UN's Office for Humanitarian Affairs has received reports that there could be as many as 130,000 more displaced persons, most in the Jebel Mara area, where the heaviest fighting has been taking place. Efforts are being made to verify those numbers, but the area in central Darfur is mostly cut off from aid workers and peacekeepers. The latest hostilities come as the United Nations and African Union are working with Khartoum to negotiate a gradual exit strategy for their joint peacekeeping mission known as UNAMID.
First, UNAMID's proposed exit strategy is based on the achievement of the mission's benchmarks, as endorsed by this council last year and premised on a political solution to the conflict based on direct talks between the parties, starting with a cessation of hostilities.
He said there would be a gradual drawdown of peacekeepers in West Darfur, where there have not been any major activities by armed groups or intercommunal fighting for 2 years. UNAMID would also close 3 other team sites in North and South Darfur. The UN also noted that the mission had collected evidence of cluster bomb use in North Darfur, which is prohibited under international law. Sudan's deputy ambassador, Hassan Hamid Hassan, rejected the grim picture the UN painted of a deteriorating security situation in central Darfur, saying the government was responding to a threat by the rebel group JEM, which had entered the country from South Sudan. He added that much of Darfur's violence is tribal in nature and that the international community could best resolve it by lifting sanctions and canceling Khartoum's debt. UNAMID, in place since 2008, has more than 16,000 soldiers and police and costs $1 billion a year to run. Its relationship with Sudan's government has been fraught with difficulties, including attacks on peacekeepers and constraints on their movements. The mission is often criticized for its ineffectiveness. Good relations are not helped by the fact that President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who recently won re-election, has been indicted by the International Criminal Court and is wanted on charges including genocide. Darfur rebels took up arms against the Sudanese government in 2003. The United Nations says the conflict has killed some 300,000 people and displaced 3 million more. Sudan puts the death toll much lower at around 10,000. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Thursday, June 11th. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Libyan officials suspect there could be up to a million illegal immigrants in the north of the country, some working, but most planning or hoping to board smugglers' boats for the perilous sea crossing to Italy. The officials say Libya, which is entangled in a civil conflict, cannot cope. VOA's Jimmy Detmer went to the Libyan capital, Tripoli, this week to see for himself the inadequacy of detention centers and filed this report.
Collins, a 30-year-old Ghanaian, is in tears when he talks to me in a noisy and crowded detention center in the Libyan capital of Tripoli.
They give us food. I want to go back to Ghana. I love my country. I just came to raise enough money to go and start my business. I was into construction business. I was renting out scaffold and tools and equipment. But just to come here, gather some money, and to enlarge my business.
He's squatting under the scorching Libyan sun in the center's yard with about 300 other illegal immigrants caught by Libyan police or militias either trying to reach Europe aboard people smuggling boats or working illegally in this strife-torn North African country. The guards order the men and boys to bow their heads, but when they hear VOA questioning why, they shout at the detainees to look up. One guard pokes them with a stick, but throws it away when a colleague whispers in his ear. Richard, a 28-year-old Ghanaian, a plasterer, says,
"We are praying that they can do something, that they can free us. If they are not freeing us, they can take us back to our country so that we can get our freedom. Okay. Because we are here, we are suffering too much. The pain is too much."
The guards at this small detention centre on Tripoli's airport road are mainly militiamen, untrained to cope with migrants, and it shows. They're doing the best they can, but lack of training, the potential threat of violence from the desperate migrants, and utterly inadequate and insanitary conditions are all making their job harder. The centre's director, Maloud Juma Salim, says the migrants come from nearly every sub-Saharan African nation. He sees me saddened by the tale of woe coming from the migrants. None, though, accuse the guards of mistreatment. He says, "I should remember that some of these men are criminals. Last night," he says, "they tried to break out through a window to escape. These people cause many problems," he says. Libyan detention centres are bulging with such migrants whose dreams of a better life in Europe are dashed. Jamie Detmer for VOA News, Tripoli.
Nigeria's ruling All Progressive Congress APC party was dealt a setback on Tuesday this week when lawmakers turned against their party while electing leaders of the National Assembly. Chris Tyne reports on what this means for the ruling party and newly inaugurated President Muhammadu Buhari.
Ever since the APC saw Mr. Buhari elected as president and won a majority of seats in Nigeria's Senate and House of Representatives, the question has lingered. Can the coalition of longtime opposition figures and defectors from the former ruling party govern together? The answer seemed to be no on Tuesday, when lawmakers in both houses collaborated with members of the opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, to go against the party leadership and elect their own candidates for Senate President and Speaker of the House of Representatives. Bukola Saraki is now Senate President, while Yakubu Dagara is now House Speaker. Both Saraki and Dagara are APC members, and the APC still has majorities in both houses. But analysts say the failure of the APC's leadership to control its lawmakers bodes ill for party unity, and perhaps also for President Buhari's agenda. Adayat Hassan is the director of the Center for Democracy and Development think tank.
They are in serious disarray as a party. It also shows them the challenge that they have to build a party. It's another thing to win office, but how to hold on to power will now be the most important thing.
Until this year, the People's Democratic Party seemed an unassailable force in Nigeria's politics. Having held the presidency every year since Nigeria returned to democracy in 1999. But after trouncing the PDP in this year's elections, the APC had the potential to wield near-absolute power in the National Assembly. Political science and director of the Center for Legislative Studies in Africa, Usman Mohammed, says the APC's failure to rally lawmakers behind its choices to lead the House and Senate left an opening for the PDP.
And your party had produced majority. Why are you now giving a crack in the wall for PDP to come in?
By helping Saraki win the Senate presidency, the PDP will now be able to influence the appointment of cabinet ministers and key aides to Mr. Buhari, Mohammed said, and perhaps leave a mark on Mr. Buhari's efforts to fight Islamist insurgent group Boko Haram and stamp out corruption. Both issues were pillars of Mr. Buhari's campaign. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
The World Health Organization said Wednesday that Sierra Leone and Guinea saw an increase in the number of Ebola cases during the week ending June 7th. The WHO said 16 new cases were found in Guinea, while 15 more were found in Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone's chief medical officer, Dr. Brahima Kabo, says the challenge for his country is that Ebola patients are escaping from their quarantined homes to seek treatment from traditional herbalists, thereby contributing to the further spread of the virus to other regions.
Week 22 and 23, we saw an increase in the number of cases compared to week 20, 21, and I think week 19. We had in week 19 about 4 cases, then week 20 about 2, and week 21 about 1 case. Then in week 22, we had 9 cases, and in week 23, we had 15 cases. So that is why they said we are not seeing an increase in the number of new cases.
As you mentioned, at the end of May, the same World Health Organization reported almost similar increase, and they said then that it would take an extraordinary effort to finish the job. What is it that Sierra Leone is not doing?
The challenge that we have is that we continue to see people escaping from quarantine homes. Of course, you remember very well in the early part of May, we went up to 8 cases without a single case. So we had quarantine homes, people escaping from quarantine homes and moved from Gambia to Port Loko and from Port Loko to the western area. But for the past 3 or 4 days, we have only seen an increased number of cases in Port Loko and Gambia because people escaped from quarantine homes. They went to their homes and they were taken to a herbalist. So this is how the disease started spreading. In Gambia, there was one herbalist. He had a son of about 29 years old who usually go out and collect these native herbs. So these were the ones that really spread the disease in Gambia. And according to informed sources, one of the women in Gambia had to escape from the quarantine home through a neighboring house and came to Port Loko. So this is how the disease spread for the past 1 to 2 weeks.
Dr. Kabo, what does this new report do to Sierra Leone's hope of being declared Ebola-free?
We have said it several times that the road to zero is going to be bumpy. We're going to have cases here and there. But with the collective efforts of our partners, we are now zooming in into this hotspot so that we ensure that people do not move from a particular village to another, just to actually ensure that after the 21 days, we're able to have an Ebola-free community. And we know it is actually very much challenging, but going with what we have as human resource, with what we have as interventions, active case surveillance, and contact tracing, I'm sure in the next 3 weeks, we'll be able to actually go again, start counting zero up to 42 days.
Dr. Brian Makabo is the chief medical officer of Sierra Leone. He was speaking with me from the capital of Freetown. Minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Goals scored by Diadi Sameseku, Gbake Diudone, and Dumbai Abubakar propelled Mali to a convincing 3-0 triumph against Ghana at the men's FIFA Under-20 World Cup in Wellington, New Zealand on Wednesday. Later in Auckland, goalkeeper Ibrahima Sey was the hero of the day as tournament debutants Senegal edged Ukraine 3-1 in a post-match penalty shootout to earn their place in the quarterfinals. Ukraine and Senegal were tied at 1-1 at the end of 120 minutes of open play. Today, Thursday, Nigeria engaged Germany in Christchurch. In Canada, tournament debutants Ivory Coast seek to get their campaign back on track when they face Thailand in a Group B tie at the FIFA Women's World Cup in Ottawa today, Thursday. Ivory Coast suffered a humiliating 10-0 loss to the world's top-ranked team Germany in their opening encounter. In Rwanda, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, is satisfied with Rwanda's ongoing preparation to stage the Orange Africa Nations Championship in January next year. The CAF's second Vice President Alamani Kabele told the Kigali media on Wednesday. Turning to athletics, Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba and Kenyan Viola Jelagat Kibiwot clash in women's 5,000 meters as East African long-distance rivalry continues at the IAAF Diamond League in Oslo, Norway today, Thursday. Kenyan Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon faces Ethiopian Dawit Seyaun in women's 1,500 meters. Djibouti's Ayanle Suleiman is favored to win the men's 1 mile, where he'll be challenged by Kenyan Asbel Kiprop and South African Johan Cronier. On the infield, South Africans Godfrey Kotso-Mokwena and Zach Fisser compete in men's long jump as Sunet Fulyun contests the women's javelin. South Africa's Anaso Jobodwana and Kenyan Calvin Nkanata compete in men's 200 meters, while Ivory Coast's Muriel Ahore and Botswana's Isaac Makwala are entered for women's 100 meters and men's 400 meters, respectively. Kenyans Ezekiel Kemboi, Jairus Birech Kipchoge, and Conseslus Kipruto are expected to dominate the men's 3,000-meter steeplechase. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Thursday morning, June 11th.
I wish to call on APC members to allow the National Assembly Status Quo to stand. The National Assembly members have voted candidates of their own choice. Parties should allow them to go ahead and face the business of the day while the Nigerians voted for them. Status Quo must stand. Comrade Mary Patrick Okorograph, who will be premised at an article in Abia State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Burundi's embattled president has officially delayed the presidential election after weeks of protests sparked by his decision to run for a third term. President Pierre Nkurunziza issued a decree on Wednesday that moves the presidential vote from June 26 to July 15th. That's it for this Thursday, June 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Butte in Washington saying have a good Thursday, Africa.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Blended sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical journey. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.